have the immense pleasure of serving as the Associate Director of Scale Arts and Lectures, and I'm delighted to welcome you to Scale Arts and Lectures' 30th anniversary season into an evening with Kayima Jess. Tonight's event is presented in partnership with the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry. Charlie Wright, the publisher of Wave Books, established the Bagley Wright Lecture Series on Poetry in memory of his late father, the businessman and philanthropist Bagley Wright. We're so grateful for their support and partnership. We'd also like to thank the many other partners who have made this series and evening possible. Thanks go to our presenting sponsor, the Seattle Times. Thanks to our series sponsor, Charles and Barbara Wright. Thanks for support for tonight from Poets and Writers. Thanks to our reception sponsor, Woodinville Wine Country, and our hotel sponsor, the Four Seasons Hotel and the Sorrento Hotel. Thanks to our poetry media partners, Poetry Northwest and Crab Creek Review. Thanks to our organizational supporters, all of whom are listed in our program, and special thanks for major support of our public programs Go for Culture, the Amazon Literary Partnership, Arts Fund, City of Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, the Four Seasons Hotel Seattle, Glossy Baby, the National Endowment for the Arts, Nordstrom, and the Washington State Arts Commission. Thanks to Open Books, Home Emporium, who is here tonight, and who will be hosting a conversation about this evening and Jess's work on March 11th at the store from 10 to 11:30 a.m. This conversation is free and open to all. Thanks so much to Open Books for extending the conversation about poetry in all ways. And most of all, thanks to all of you for being here with us tonight. Could we have a round of applause for all of our supporters? The format for this evening will be a reading and talk by Kayima Jess. Jess will be then joined on stage for a conversation with Anastasia Renee, Seattle's civic poet and the author of three collections of poetry in the last year alone. Anastasia will include as many questions from you as should we have time for, so if you have a question for the poet, please write it on a card in your program and pass it to an usher. If you are on social media this evening, our hashtag is SalJess. And to open our evening, I'm proud to introduce a student from our Writers in the Schools program. Tonight's reader, Zushin Zhang, will read a poem he wrote last year at Franklin High School with writer Nikita Oliver. Please join me in welcoming Zushin Zhang.
Mind to my heart, a message to me. One of those late night conversations, and I found me, the real me. Age 18, I understand now. Took the time to look back, and I thought, wow. Childhood, it was a lockdown. Locked between the people who gave birth to me, defined as parents, society called it family. Disagreeing, I thought it was more of a dysfunctionality. No mom with only a dad figure, I needed to be at least grateful for having a father and a mother. The smallest things they did do matter. Senior year in high school, I looked back. Every disconnection became a reflection. I saw me, and I finally understood everything. February 14, 2018, the day of Valentine's became the beginning of the real me. My mind was 10 years ahead, my heart was 1 year behind, but now I'm all caught up. Throwing all the negative thoughts to the side, it was all positivity on my mind. No one was going to stop me. No, I don't have the time. Friends is family, there's no stopping now. We keep things 100, like we brothers and sisters. Knowing we got each other's backs, no fake stuff, we know how to keep it together. This poem is my reflection of the times when I wanted to pack. Always looking back, it allowed the past to control my path. It is what it is, and you just gotta do what you gotta do. You get through and you'll live. Pick up those pieces and find the way to keep moving up. There isn't an option to turn back. You got everything you need, don't ever stop. The road doesn't end till you believe it does. This is the real Zushin, the people don't normally see. I take my chances to grow my success. I give my heart to any people of age. I don't want to regret all the friends I can make. My family will keep growing, so will my success. I live my life through poetry because poetry saved me. This poem is where I begin, the path of the real me.
Back to Seattle Arts and Lectures. Jess last read for Sal after his first book, Lead Belly, was published in 2005. You could say that his follow-up collection, Olio, was 10 years in the making. Or you could say that it was 154 years in the making, beginning as it does with Blind Tom playing for the Confederate troops in 1863. Or you could say that it was hundreds of years in the making, since it is rooted in that terrible history of slavery in our country. Just as making is a tribute to and an unearthing of those 19th century makers of music, the black musicians who, in Wave's book's words, met, resisted, complicated, co-opted, and sometimes defeated attempts to minstrelize them. Literary Hub described Olio as a, quote, book-length performance of poetry, song, collage, and art object. And Jeff said in an interview that this book is about deconstructing our received history and reconstructing it in a way through poems and through prose in a way that helps us better understand it. Blending research with narrative, weaving fact and fiction, just brings these performers to life with stunning craft. His syncopated sonnets alone are a feat of creative engineering and innovation, and the physical book itself literally reinvents the technology of the book. It is a wonder, and no wonder then that it garnered the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry and Jeff for Jess, and the first Pulitzer for Wave Books, who deserves a shout out as well for investing in this beautiful object, this perforated performance of performances, this multi-layered history of hearts and music. Its tear out sheets tear us out, tear us up. Rich Smith and The Stranger wrote that Olio constitutes a scientific advancement in the art of poetry, and that is true. Please join me in welcoming the poet, the historian, the architect of the new old and the old new, the maker, the unearther, the worder, the sonneteer to end all sonneteers, and the singer of those who sang, Taiba Jess.
Tonight. it's really fantastic to be here. Last time I was on this stage, I believe, was around 2005 or 2006. So it's really great to be back in this beautiful city of Seattle. And I want to shout out to Isaac Castile for that fantastic song. We were just talking about Slim and Slam. Y'all know Slim and Slam? Mm-hmm. If you don't know Slim and Slam, we were talking about Slim and Slam before, and you got up there, you know, messing with that contrabass, like, oh, okay, all right. Zujin, I hope I'm saying that correctly. Thank you for that poem. There was one line you said in there. You said, "Poetry saved me." And I know where you're coming from, brother. I know exactly where you're coming from, because that is the way I feel about poetry in my lifetime. It has definitely reached out a hand and saved me. Now I want to send out a shout to Joshua Beckman and Heidi Broadhead over there from Wave Press. I talk about the crafts that was put into this book every time I do a reading, because there's very, very few, and maybe not hardly any other press that would take a book and do what they were able to do, that has the knowledge, the know-how, the context, and the will to do what they did, what Wave Press did with this book. So, shout out to them. All right. Coming out here while the Oscars are on. You know what I'm saying? These are the people who decide, I'll just check it later.
Yeah.
All right, so thank you. My competition is. All right. So I'm going to read some poems from this book, Olio. And Olio, just to start off with the title, Olio means a mix of melange and ingredients that come together to form a meal. In the context of American theater, the olio was the middle part of the minstrel show. And the minstrel show was started early 19th century, essentially with the idea of making fun of blackness, white actors and comedians making fun of blackness by putting on blackface and dressing in a certain way and acting as buffoons, making fun of blackness and carrying a kind of entertainment and really a kind of psychological warfare in their performance. There was a performance about indignity. That was about otherness, and that was about degradation. Just a small understanding on the history of the minstrel show was the primary form of American entertainment. The roots of American theater go back to the minstrel show. The very first character of the Jim Crow show, of the minstrel show was called Jim Crow, okay? And we know what the history of that name, that title was linked to the segregation laws that held inequity in place throughout American history and really wasn't legally overturned until the year I was born, okay, when the Civil Rights Act was passed. And still, that happens de facto in many ways today. So, the Olio was the middle part of the minstrel show, as I was saying, in which a variety of acts could come on stage and entertain the crowd. So it could be a juggler, it could be a dancer, it could be a piano player, etc. And towards the beginning of the 20th century, the minstrel show kind of faded away, and the OEO became kind of evolved into what we know as vaudeville. And then, of course, it went into the Great White Way. So that's a brief history on the minstrel show and the OEO. Now, what's in this book are the stories of various black folks who, directly after the Civil War, decided to take their skills and use their creative energies in order to make creative careers for themselves. So in this book, there are folks that were both enslaved and lived into the years post the Civil War and were able to launch their careers, and the people who started their careers after the Civil War. So Blind Tom, who was blind and autistic and owned by the same family, the Bethune family, and earned $1 million for that family by the time he died in the early part of the 20th century. Sissy Retta Jones is in this book. She was the first black singer at Carnegie Hall in 1892, really before it was even called Carnegie Hall. The McCoy twins, we're gonna visit in a minute. Several other folks are, but I'm gonna introduce you to a few. Is that cool?
Yeah.
That's it. Okay, so I'm gonna I'd like to start with our introduction to the McCoy twins. And these are them. McCoy twins were twins born into slavery in 1849. So they are not just standing back to back in this picture, they are Pythagoras twins, meaning they are joined essentially from the bottom of the rib cage all the way through the spine, through the pelvis, okay? Two independent minds joined in the same body. Two separate heads, as you can see, and two separate sets of legs, okay? And I wanted to write a series of poems that would detail their journey and address some of the quandaries of their life and consequently of the decision-making process of the man that owned them. Okay. So I want to start, right here. So what this is a syncopated sign. Can y'all read this in the back? Yes?
Yes.
Okay, good, I wanna make sure everybody can read it. Because what this is a concrete poem. A concrete poem basically is a poem that takes the form of the subject. Okay, and in this case, we have two separate heads. We have a combined middle, and we have two separate heads. And this is just a form of sonnet, right? That is using two voices and bringing them together. So if we read down the middle, we read, there, and we were to imagine the twins being here together, they would be together. We're fused in blood and body from one throne stem, but in twin blooms of song. We're a double rose, grown from hard labor that made our mother shout, spent with awe. We hymn to pay soft homage, born of and beyond the flesh. We are just two women singing truths we can't forget. Okay? That's an interstitial reading, just meaning that you're skipping certain lines. On the other side, if we read just Millie's side of the equation, we've mended two songs in the one dark-skinned, bleeding soprano into contralto, descended from raw carnage of the South, bursting open our freedom. We sing past rage to the work song's aria. It leaves us soaked in history like our father's sweat from plantation to grave. Lord, here we are, free twin sisters who've hauled our voices far. For me, just Christine's side of the equation. We ride the wake of each other's rhythm, beating our heart's syncopated tempo with a music all our own. With our mouths seeped in the glow of hand-me-down courage, drenched in spiritual acapellas, flowing soul from bone through skin. We pay debts from broken chattel to circus stars. We sing straight from this nation's barbed-wired heart. And if we were to encounter the poem in its entirety, you can imagine them trading lines, so to speak. Going from Millie to Christine, and the lines in the middle being read by both of them. It'll be as such. We've mended two songs in the one dark skin. We ride the wake of each other's rhythm, bleeding soprano into contralto, beating our heart's syncopated tempo. We're fused in blood and body from one throne stem, but in twin blooms of song. We're a double rose descended from raw carnage of the South, with a music all our own, with our mouths bursting open our freedom. We sing past rage, seeped in the glow of hand-me-down courage, grown from hard labor that made our mothers shout, spent with awe. We hymn to pay soft homage to the work song's aria. It leaves us drenched in spiritual acapellas, soaked in history like our father's sweat flowing soul from bone through skin. We pay debts born of and beyond the flesh. We are just two women singing truths we can't forget from plantation to grave. Lord, here we are, from broken chattel to circus stars, free twin sisters who've hauled our voices far, we sing straight from this nation's barbed wire heart. Nice. And how many sonnet tears we got? So for those of you who are not familiar with the structure of a sonnet, it follows a rhyme scheme that's basically A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G, like you studied through the alphabet, so to speak. And in this case, it's you can see the rhyme scheme as skin, contralto, stem, rose, south, rage, shout, homage, us, sweat, just forget, R, far, right? See that A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G, right? And so these are true Shakespearean sonnets, I should say. So on the other side, we have rhythm, tempo, stem, rose, and mouths, courage, shout, homage, acapellas, debts, justice, forget, and then stars and hearts. So it's two sides right here, okay? I just wanted to stay faithful to the scheme of the sonnet, because sonnets were very popular in the 19th century, and I wanted to kind of be in that space where the twins would be identified in that way. So, as I was said before, I was curious about how they manage their circumstances. And one question would be, well, if you own some Pygopicus twins born on your plantation in 1849, a question for you as a slave owner might be, how are you going to make money from this product born on your plantation? The answer that our owner came up with was this: to lease them out at the age of about a little bit over a year, to lease them out to a traveling freak show. They would take them from county to county, village to village, town to town, and put them on display over and over and over again to crowds paying, you know, 5 cents, 10 cents, or perhaps, you know, and taking part of those profits from having these little girls on display all across the countryside. The other part of that is that every time they stopped into a new town, there would be curious physicians. They would want to A, verify product, verify that they were indeed Pygopicus twins, and also satisfy their own medical curiosity about seeing really a medical miracle. So as a result, these little girls were inspected over and over and over and over and over again in the rudest possible fashion, going from town to town to town to town. This happened throughout their bondage until they achieved emancipation. At that time, they got an affidavit that swore to the fact that they were Pygopicus twins. They no longer had to endure as many intrusions upon their privacy. And this next poem is about that. Millie Christine on display. If we read down the middle, of course, we see the conjoined voice. We count the blessings of our doubled shell as we pay our dues. We've proven ourselves for science. We've been taken town to town like prize bovine. We've been pawed up and down. Each sawbone has searched us from spine to loin. Our wondrous oneness exists. We're conjoined. We're not frauds, but born of providence. God mended two souls into one dark skin. And as this is a syncopated sonnet, contrapuntal form, counterpoint, point, counterpoint, one point being on one side and then going back and forth in their conversation. I'd like to introduce to you a different kind of flexibility that these particular poems have and are able to afford the reader, because the reader has a different kind of agency in these poems in that they may start in different places on the poem and still get the message of the poem. So for instance, you might want to start at the bottom. God made the two souls into one dark skin. We're not frauds, but born of providence, and we've listened to doctors who understand. We've been probed, prodded, and roughly examined from my twin's navel to between her thighs. Been photographed, half nude, verified to those who doubt our form. We have performed with each breath. We prove we've endured faith's storm. We count the blessings of our doubled cell every time we rise to face the proud's face on display. We've been richly, rudely paid to prove veracity. They scanned each side and then back up, staring into my eyes from backbone to backbone, from hip to hip. Our miracle is real. Hear and see this. We're not frauds, but born of providence. God made the two souls into one dark skin. We're not frauds, but born of providence. Our wondrous oneness exists. We're conjoined. Each sawbone has searched us from spine to loin like prize bovine. We've been pawed up and down for science. We've been taken town to town as we pay our dues. We've proven ourselves. We count the blessings of our double shell. These poems give the reader the possibility to take different angles throughout the body of the poem. Okay? So one can encounter going down and also up in various other ways, as we'll see. But to continue their story, turns out if you're the kind of guy that's going to take a couple of 1-2-year-old girls who are conjoined and put them in freak shows all across the country, you might be of the moral stature that would say, I want to keep all this money for myself. And that is exactly what happened. The man that had taking him around the country said, you know what? To keep this dough for myself, how do I do that? Can't stay in the United States, because I'll be caught. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna put him on a boat, take him to England, and put on this show all over again in London. That's what he did. So then another quandary comes up for their owner, which is, how do I get my money back? And his solution was this: take their mother, Monimia, go on a boat to England with them, track them down, because they were being advertised in various places, and go to one of their performances, barge in. And then as soon as these little girls see their mother, when they haven't seen her for months, first thing they say is, Mommy. And that is part of the claim of the slave owner, right? I own her, they're her kids, I owe them. I owned it. So he's put forth his claim to these little girls. This is happening in England around the year 1851, which also proves a quandary for their mother. Because in England in 1851, at that time, slavery had been abolished. So the question was, does a mother stay in England and try to sue for the rights of herself to freedom and of her little girls? Or go back to the United States where she had five other kids and a husband? Such were the dilemmas of a peculiar institution. This poem is about exactly that. If we start at the bottom, we see the answer she came up with. Straight from the Dixie's rebellious mouth, our mother left England and went back south. Choosing between homeland and untold harms, we returned to a master we could trust. We went back to bondage in mother's arms. We earned a London court's sympathy, and thus, though we missed family, were we not blessed? The thief's greed has set us free. Although bonded, we've been smuggled to freedom's soil, and yes, we've been stolen from mother and master, absconded like contraband. We've been shipped to Britain at the age of three. We've been kidnapped afar, been rented and sold, then snatched, taken straight from America's barbed wire heart like double dark treasures, entertainment at the age of three. We've been kidnapped afar, imported by a scallywag agent. We've been stolen from mother and master, absconded from slavery. We'd slipped into liberty. The thief's greed had set us free. Although bonded, because of our great popularity, we'd earned the London court sympathy, and thus we sailed back to our Carolina home. We returned to a master we could trust. Torn between family or freedom's unknowns, our mother left England and went back south, straight into Dixie's rebellious. Throughout the period of chattel slavery in the United States. After the Civil War, they got their emancipation. And the question was attended upon them, well, how are we going to make our money? How are we going to survive? This is the same question that millions of black folks were asking themselves after the emancipation, after the Civil War. Their answer was to continue in the freak shows, but with affidavits that were testified to the fact that they were indeed pygopagous doings, so they no longer had to subject themselves or be subjected to these constant examinations. And they went on the road, mostly in freak shows. And they traveled throughout the South and throughout the nation and actually throughout the world. Now, at this point, I'd like to say that they did just not stand and get gawked at. That was not their act. They were quite talented. They spoke multiple languages, okay? They played multiple instruments. They danced. They sang. Duets, right? They were quite a show. They were very, very successful. And they became very, very popular. They, you know, performed for queens and kings and dukes, earls, etc. Went all through Europe, etc. They were quite a hit. They were a big deal. And as they went through Europe and throughout the United States, becoming a big deal, they got a little bit of coin that turned into some big coin. And what they would do with that coin is they would send it back to their mother and father, who were still in North Carolina. And what did they do with that money? Well, what their mother and father did was eventually save up ducat by ducat, pound by pound, franc by franc, dollar by dollar. They saved that money up and they bought the plantation upon which they had been slaves. That land has stayed in the family about five generations. Some of them are still down there.
Wow.
So this next poem is about that. Millie Christine by land. I'm living in Brooklyn right now. My land. and sisters who've heard our voices far. We're singing in Dreisbach und Machen es Schwarz. Now, that means roughly in German, we sing in three languages and make them black. We speak more than one tongue. Wherever we roam, this gift's pure gold. While we travel the road with dimes hoarded by pinching francs and pounds against servitude. We sing freedom bound with duets all mingled up to heaven. We bought land that once enslaved our parents with duets all mingled up to heaven, and we know the cost. We've overcome against servitude. We sing freedom bound from each gawking crowd. Meanwhile, dollars stack. With dimes hoarded by pinching francs and pounds, we pay mortgage on our old plantation. This gift's pure gold. While we travel the road, we earn respect. We give solid proof that we speak more than one tongue. Wherever we roam, nous savons chanter la française à Paris. Excuse my terrible French accent. We're singing in Dreisbach und Machen es Schwarz. We're a certified global phenomena. We're free to insist as if hard our voices far. Okay? So I can go. I think you're getting the point. Right? This last poem, this penultimate poem, is just about their love story. Now, they died in the very first decade of the 20th century. One died of pneumonia. The other one died about within a day. Oh. They knew that they had come together, and they knew that they were going to go out together. But they were very proud of the way that they came on the planet and did not bemoan their status or the way that they came to visit us. Mm-hmm. So, Marie Christine's love story. Here, this is our story I want you to hear. One body crooning two notes. By God, we're in unison. Listen to the grace we have ringing within me and my other half, airborne, shook and shimmering through my head like sympathetic strings. Each sung sound with Christine's voice at my side. I have sung in a way very few could comprehend, so you can see my life is brimmed. It's full with every breath we've got. I'm filled completely with soul's blaze. This is how I know love, the way any other human would love. I live each day like I won't see its night. I love my song and dance and family the way you love your own blood, twice as much. I double the cause to celebrate life. I love this burden that we've been given to ride the shared wake of one blood's rhythm. I love this burden that we've been given the way you love your own blood, twice as much. I love my song and dance and family. I live each day like I won't see its night. With every breath we've got, I'm filled completely. So you can see my life is brimmed. It's full in a way very few could comprehend. With Christine's voice at my side, I have sung with Millie's embracing contrapuntal, airborne, shook and shimmering through my head like sympathetic strings. Each sung sound, one body crooning two notes. By God, we're ringing within me and my other half in unison. Listen to the grace we have here. This is our story. I want you to hear. I don't plan the way I'm going to go through these poems. No, I don't. It's all ad hoc. It's well, pretty much off the cuff. The idea being that you can do the same thing, but you just need to, you know, every line leads to every adjoining line, and lines in the same column read interstitially. Down and also up. So the reader gets a kind of agency here in the reading of these syncopated signs. Now, there's one thing that I wanted to accomplish, or the kind of idea that has to do with sonnets that I wanted to make. That is called a crown of sonnets. Crown of sonnets is when the last line of one sonnet becomes the first line of the next sonnet, and the last line of that sonnet becomes the first line of the next sonnet. So they end up, and then the last line of the last sonnet becomes the first line of the first sonnet, and that makes a circle. That's why they call it the crown of sonnets. And I couldn't make that happen. A little out of my parameters. However, I was able to use lines like, we've made it two songs and one dark skin. Right with the world's rhythm. We sing straight from the station's barbed wire heart. Free twin sisters of heart, our voices far. At the very bottoms and tops of that initial poem. And weave them into the other poem. So God made it two souls and the one dark skin. Right? Or straight from America's barbed wire heart. Or We're free to insist as hard our voices far, or to ride the shirt wake of one blood's rhythm. So when that happens, and when you link those lines together, you end up with something that looks like that, which is a star. To read from the very top through the middle, all the way down, and then perhaps back up, and then perhaps down again, and then perhaps back up, and then perhaps all the way to the other side, and then perhaps down again, whichever way you desire to follow the story of McCoy twins. In this case, this is what, once again, what you call a concrete poem, right? It takes the form of the twins, two separate heads, a conjoined middle, and two separate bases. So you are looking at the corporeal image, like the representation, the corporeal image of the McCoy twins. But when you are gazing, when you are going through, when your eye is following the same course that it might when you were seeing them on display, or in this case, taking in their story. Okay, so that's the star of syncopated signs. And when you buy the book, you will see that that poem folds out. So that you can see it in its entirety. Okay. There you go. So that's the star of syncopated signs for the McCoy twins. So I'd like to introduce some other folks to you from the book. Is that cool?
Yeah.
Excellent. The next folks I want to introduce you to are, well, let's see if I can get their picture here right. These gentlemen right here, that is Burt Williams and George Walker. They're two comedians born in the mid-1870s. Okay? Burt Williams, his people are from the Bahamas. He actually came out of, if I remember correctly, came out of California. But these two gentlemen wanted to be comedians. Two black men born in mid-1870s wanted to be comedians. How is that gonna happen? Well, it's not gonna happen without the structure of the minstrel show, okay? And there was no other mechanism for them to get in front of audiences and to perform other than the minstrel show. So that is what they did. They were in minstrel shows. They were minstrels. They wore makeup, okay? The whole nine yards. They did their act. Now, they became very famous in their act. Not just because they were funny, but because they added dimensionality to their characters. So the minstrel show is about making a caricature of black. It's about making a flat depiction of an entire race of people. And what they were doing, they entered themselves into that paradigm. But they also were able to create characters that not just make the audience laugh, but also made them cry. So they were adding substance and depth to the character, and they were making characters. They were very successful at their job. They were so successful that they were able to come out of the minstrel tradition and were responsible for some of the very first independent African-American theater productions put on in this country. And then I might add they were well-respected. Booker T. Washington used to go and see their shows, et cetera, et cetera. Right? They were very well-paid, too. You know, right? My man George Walker had came with thousands of dollars of diamonds on the tip of his nose, right? Very well healed, gentlemen. Okay. So I want to do a poem about them, and I guess I wanted to set it up. And one of the ways I wanted to set it up was with this book, The Whitmark Amateur Minstrel Guy. This is published in 1905. And when you in the poem I'm about to show you, okay, there's an excerpt from this book. It's called The Whitmark Amateur Minstrel Guy and Burnt Cork Encyclopedia, okay? True title. It's just a handy dandy guide on Well, you just might want to put on a minstrel show at your, I don't know what your elementary school, Lions Club, at your church, perhaps, right? And this was a handy dandy guide on how to do it. This is not my text. This is taken directly from the book. Okay, but I think it's important to have this in here. It's called the flower poem. Right? I wanted to have this in the book because I need people to understand how pervasive the minstrel show was. All right. So this is the text, and I think it's interesting. It says. The Ford vocalist a chance to come out in solo or concerted work, and the young comedians or dancers excellent opportunities to shine forth and give full vent to their humor and wit. And minstrelsy is the one American form of amusement purely our own. And it has lived and thrived even though the plantation darky who first gave it a character has departed. This has information on how to black up, burning cork in a can, smothering with grease, putting it on your face, etc. And of course, at the end, it has been the aim of the writer to provide for the young amateur a gold mine in which to delve and draw forth chunks of fun to spring upon his audience. He has also endeavored to make this book a veritable encyclopedia of everything pertaining to minstrels. At the same time, he has not forgotten to build a work to which the reader can turn and peruse in seeking funny literature, or a remedy for that tired feeling called ennui. Or force the blues, as we would call it. That's the only change I made in the text. So I wanted that poem is on the opposite side of this next poem, which is the Burt Williams George Walker paradox. Yeah. So what this is also in a poetic form. You just dealt with sonnets. Now what we're seeing right here is two ghazals, spelled G-H-A-Z-A-L, Indo-Arabic form, roughly 1,000 years old. Okay. And it's really actually kind of started off as song and drifted into literature, okay, in American literature, it's used quite a bit. So there's a couple rules to a ghazal. We have two standing up here together, like two stand-up comedians trading lines, okay? And one rule is that there has to be repetition of a word or a phrase in every other line. In this case, you have nobody. Nobody, nobody, nobody. Now nobody, I don't know if it was playing before you guys were sitting down, but you can find it on YouTube, you can find it. Very famous tune authored by Burt Williams. Very famous tune sung throughout the tree. Still a jazz standard today. On my soundtrack, I have Nina Simone singing it, Johnny Cash singing it, and a current jazz vocal. City, all right? Still relevant. On the other side, we have face. Of course, blackface being the call sign here. So what I'd like to do is to read this with you. Okay? Mm-hmm. All right. So you can follow the cursor as we go. Jonah, the charcoal hole of the way, doing justice to my jubilee. See how I dance. Just might be playing you for a fool. You see, this face be smiling till the crowd starts to cry. This nobody got them laughing loud like me. You think they mock my face? Can't help but see themselves just me beneath my blacked up face, wondering about dark's pathos. Believe the human being swept up in my diamond stud struts. Bless those that wonder about dark's pathos. Believe the human being buried beneath my ash. Don't claim that nobody get in touch from inside out. Every wide-eyed face in the crowd all gupping with laughter. They know that they hold in secret smiles for another man's plights. A shame knuckled under humor. Who escapes it? Nobody knuckled under humor. Who escapes it? Nobody will be baptized clean. I want to make it so. Each face remember my tale. Not hopeless, but lonely. One teared up in tears, then torn down sad. A soiled soul teared up in tears, then torn down sad. A soiled soul full of fret about humanity. is marked on my face, full of bulging eyes, cakewalking along to ragtime, getting blistered with spotlight. That's my mask, not my face, getting blistered with spotlight. That's my mask, not my face, making folk double take what they see. I'm the straight man, making folk double take what they see. I'm the straight man, struggling not to fade away. That's the role that I play. Cooning my coon songs, paint my strife. They claim nobody yearning for tragic Negro to uplift them, to buck, tickle with slapstick blackness. I'll color each white face, tickle with slapstick blackness. I'll color each white face teary when I mind the losing card game. I want them all grimmed up and stay sharp, or I can't get nobody beyond the skin. Here in my show, they are me. They'll be themselves. See, most crowds know nothing about nobody living neath Quark's costume. My crowds got the faceless face trying to rise up the race. We're two real coons, proud of trying to rise up the race. We're two real coons, proud of sitting, spitting back high-class grace from all the bile been swallowed, trying to rise up the race. We're two real coons, proud of rising through blackface. Some claim how we ain't nobody being sent here to ponder on pie. But we sweat cold pushing past the coon. We'll make theaters about face, make a theater about us. Plays of paradox, closing the curtain on coon shows. That is our mission, closing the curtain on coon shows. That is our mission, slowly erasing darky to dawn a human face, working with a truth that smothers Jim Crow stitch. We are beholden only to the self. Can't stop nobody beholden only to the self. Can't stop nobody doing the work we're born to do. See, we want to be free. We wake up to mirrors full of slick black faces, dead set to swagger into undeferred dream. Look, we're reflecting how every live soul holds a dream. We're dead set to swagger into undeferred dream. Look, we're sure of the price, what our ass worth. Bet you nobody watches the darkness. I'll shine the crowd. I have each face, sure of the price, what our act's worth. Bet you nobody reflected on how every live soul holds a dream. We're free. Welcome to mirrors full of slick black faces. Behold it only to the self. Can't stop nobody doing the work we're born to do. See, we want to be doing the work we're born to do. See, we want to be working with a truth that smothers Jim Crow stench. We are telling real human comedies. That's us. Nobody slowly erasing darkened the dawn of human face, closing the curtain on coon shows. That is our mission. Closing the curtain on coon shows. That is our mission. Making theater about us. Plays of paradox, mining joy out of hurt. That's better than nobody mining joy out of hurt. That's better than nobody changing the game a bit. We've made ourselves somebody's being sent here to ponder on pride. But we sweat cold when we've sophisticated samples lots. We're that face rising through blackface. Some claim how we ain't nobody spitting back high class grace from all the bob and swallow trying to rise up the race. We're two real coons, proud of living neath coarse costume. My crowds got to face this face themselves. See, most crowds know nothing about nobody themselves. See, most crowds know nothing about nobody beyond the skin. Here in my show, they are me. They'll be clowning with minds freed up. They see me, and soon they get clowning with minds freed up. They see me, and soon they get rolling in eyes each time. Have you seen their faces? All grinned up. I stay sharp where I can't get nobody tearing in a mind loosened card game. I want them filled with black magic. Don't tell me that ain't nobody filled with black magic. Don't tell me that ain't nobody tickled with slapstick blackness. I'll color each white face, yearning for tragic Negro to uplift them, to buck, big enough to snicker itself on white folks' faces. Crooning my coon songs, paint my stripes. They claim nobody crooning my coon songs paint my strife. They claim nobody making folk double take what they see. I'm the straight man making folk double take what they see. I'm the straight man struggling not to fade away. That's the role that I play. Speaking low of my woe. I little fame don't hurt nobody atop a dancing darkness shining hard. No, I'm not full of bulging eyes. Keep walking along to ragtime full of fret about humanity. It's masked on my face full of fret about humanity. It's masked on my face. Birds to sing fresh out of pain. I sang like nobody. Birds to sing fresh out of pain. I sang like nobody. Remembering my tale. Not hopeless, but lonely. One will be baptized clean. I want to make it so. Each face knuckled under humor. Who escapes it? Nobody knuckled under humor. Who escapes it? Nobody holding secret smiles for another man's plight. A shame getting touched from inside out. Every wide-eyed face being buried beneath my ash. Don't claim that nobody being swept up in my diamond stud strut. Bless those that wondering about the dark's pathos. Believe the human might be saying, look at that handsome man. Nobody might be saying, look at that handsome man. Nobody got them laughing loud like me. You think they mock my face? Born a little all about race. A sure bet, nobody just might be playing you for a fool. You see, this face just might be playing you for a fool. You see, this face be smiling till the crowd starts to cry. There's nobody sing like me, Jonah in the charcoal hole of the whale, doing justice to my jibber jig. See how I dance? Doing justice to my jibber jig. See how I dance? Doing justice to my jibber jig. See how I dance?
All right.
Now I wanted to show it to you in the book, because I need to show you. Here it is. It folds out the book, as you can see, right? And then on the other side you have the quote from the Whitman Amateur Minstrel Guide, inside the key. There's another aspect of the book that I'm gonna tip my hat to wave once again. It took a lot to do this. Now I've never held this book before in my life, right? Okay. What I'm gonna show you is this: that there are perforations. Y'all hit me in the back.
Yeah.
There are perforations along the edges of the fold-out pages. And boom. Every time I do this, these pages never tear. That's Heidi and Josh.
Yeah.
Every page on the book I need you to see that you can do that. And actually, what I want you to do, part of the capability or part of the mission of this book is to deconstruct the book, right, in order to reconstruct the history of the people inside the book, okay? Why, though? Why in this particular case? Because now that you have torn it out of the book, right, what we have here is on one side the rules, on the other side the poem, right? And we have, of course, a two-dimensional representation here, right, of Burt Williams and George Walker. This on an XY axis, okay? XY. Who's the math people in the house? My wife's a math teacher, so she don't brush me up. Right? XY axis. Two dimensions. Yes. However, what we have here also is a relationship between the left side of the page and the right side of the page, and the right and the left, okay? And it's a coherent relationship. You see this face, he's smiling to the crowd, starts to cry. Can't help but see themselves just beneath my blacked up face, might be saying, look at that handsome man. Every wide-eyed face being buried beneath my ash, et cetera, et cetera. Right? Also, I will say that whenever there is a period or a colon in one of the line becomes recursive around that period. So, for instance, every wide-eyed face getting touched from inside out. Or, I want to make it so each face will be baptized clean. Or a soiled soul teared up in tears and torn out. Essentially, what that means is that, can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Is that there's a relationship between the right and the left side of the page. And that means you can bring those two sides together. Okay? And when you do that, you no longer are in a two-dimensional representation. You're in a cylinder, right? Going to a three-dimensional representation, right? That also happens with the top and the bottom of the page, right? Because the bottom reads into the top, and the top also reads directly into the bottom coherently, okay? So once again, you have a two-dimensional representation, right, into a three-dimensional representation. And that also means you can do both of those things at the same time. So when you do that, this is deconstructing in order to reconstruct. When you do that, right, you end up with something that looks a little bit like that. Right? And that means that this can be read. I'm going to tell you, for any geometry fans in the house, what you have here is called a flat torus. T-O-R-U-S. Flat. When you bring the sides together, it becomes an actual torus, which is basically the shape of a donut or a bagel, whichever one you add to this one. Which can be read around and around on the inside, and around on the outside, going both ways, okay? And also from side to side, continue, okay? Now, so you've gone from a two-dimensional reputation to a three-dimensional reputation, in much the way that the Burt Williams and George Walker were trying to ply their trade in a two-dimensional paradigm called the minstrel show. But where they were able to manipulate their words and the audience in such a way that they were able to create depth in their characters, right? So they went from caricature to character with depth, right? And that's what's happening here with this particular poem. Furthermore, they were facing a paradox, right? And the paradox was being in this very degrading vehicle of American entertainment and trying to wrestle some kind of self-respect out of that. And that means, well, paradoxes, maybe if you take one side and a half twist, and they still read them to each other, going back and forth, and just flipping sides and recoherently, that is a Mobius strip.
Yeah.
And that is the paradox. That's the Burt Williams, George Walker paradox. At the same time, having the rules of the game twisted up inside, and twisting those rules in order to internalizing but twisting those rules in order to fit one's own definition of the craft. Okay? There you go.
Yeah.
Like every poem has a story, man, you know? And now I'm like, I hate long introductions, but this, it just kind of happens with these things. It's funny, when you say the word history, people start to go to sleep, right? When you say a story, perhaps it becomes a different thing. This is a story about the Fisk Jubilee Singers. Who's heard of that? Fisk Jubilee Singers, okay? That's, who's heard of spirituals before? All right, many more people. If you ever listened to a spiritual in the United States, that spiritual owes a debt to the Fisk Jubilee Singers. Who were they? They were students. They were essentially newly freed slaves. Right after the Civil War, talking 1867, early 1870s, went to Fisk University, which was really pretty much just being built at that time. Still down in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, you have some students there. They go to classes, of course, they don't have the internet, you know? They don't have, you know, video games or whatever. They don't have YouTube. How do they entertain themselves? Well, they sing. They sing the songs that their grandmothers and their grandfathers and their mothers and fathers were brought from the field. Those are called work songs. Those are called spirituals. These are the songs that sustained them through very difficult times in slavery. So, they're singing these songs after classes. One of the instructors hears them. He's never heard this sound before. And he takes them on the road. And essentially, they become a hit. Very long story, very short, become a hit. And they are essentially missionaries. Not just of religion through the spirituals that they're singing, but also of black humanity. Of the humanity and soul of black folks being voiced through them in their songs, being going all over the world. So I wrote a crown of sonnets for them, and in the sonnets, they essentially go in the voices of these nine folks, right? And I finished the sonnet. This is very actually one of the hardest parts of the book, was doing this song, this crown of sonnets. And one of the things that occurred to me 6 years or so into writing the book was that what these poems needed was context for this level of spirituality. And what occurred to me through the Black Lives Matter movement was the idea of say their names, say their names, say their names. And what occurred to me that also was attended to the history of the spiritual and the black church is the burning of black churches. So the context as I was able to provide was essentially researching the history of burnt black churches in the United States, of sabotage and attacked and bombed and burnt black churches, which there, I was able to find about 148 names of black churches that have been burnt. Now, and this poem, it's the first poem in the book, is the Fisk Jubilee Proclamation. And the other part of the story is this, is that I came up with this idea very late in the production, and I came up and I researched the churches. And then a man walked into a church in South Carolina and assassinated 9 of the members after praying for 4 hours. And I caught a wave. I think I talked to Heidi, and I said, you know, this name has to go in the back of the book, in that very last, it's a chronological list, right? So it became the very last church in the book. Then I researched the history of that church. Turned out it had been burnt to the ground in 1822, because Denmark Vesey tried to stage a slave revolt and went to that church. So it ended up being the very first church and the very last church in this list. So this is in the tradition, I would say, of the Crown of Silence. Right? Well, the very first line is the last line. This is dedicated to Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, 1822. Cross Ankle Church in Palmetto, Georgia, 1899. Greenleaf Presbyterian Church in Killeen, Tennessee, 1900. Red Top Church in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, 1915. First Baptist Church in Carteret, New Jersey, 1926. Fulton Street and Methodist Church, Chicago, Illinois, 1927. Second Baptist Church, my hometown, Detroit, Michigan, 1930. Macedonia Baptist Church, Egg Harbor City, New Jersey, 1935. Mount Methodist Church, Henderson, North Carolina, 1940. Negro Methodist Church, Loganville, Georgia, 1947. The Fisk Jubilee Proclamation, the epigraph is from Psalm 96, which says in part, "Oh, sing unto the Lord a new song." Oh, sing. Undo the world with blue song, born from newly freed throats, sprung loose from lungs once bound within bonded skin, scored from dawn to dust with cuffle and lash, every tongue unfurled as the body's flag, every breath conjured despite loss we've had, bear witness to the birthing of our hymn from storied depths of America's sin. Soul-worn songs, blessed in our blood through dark lessons of the past, struggling to be heard. Behold, the bold sound we found in ourselves that was hidden, cast out of the garden of freedom. It's loud and unbeaten, then soft as a newborn's face, each note bursting loose from human bondage.
Look it up when you leave. This is very important, very important. Wow. So if you have questions for Tayamba, I urge you to write them on cards and send them to the ushers, and I'll be taking them and reading your questions along with mine. Let's get into it. I have a lot to ask you. Are you ready?
Yes.
You ready, ready?
Ready.
Poet, neck, petition, sanitaire, all those things. So you're a black man.
That is true.
And I didn't know, I have to point it out. You happen to be a black man living within white supremacy. What do you say to people who either say, your work is so timely now, or people who say, your work is very historical?
Well, my work is about time. It's about history. I'm just gonna say that this one thing I tell my students is that it really behooves one to study history and understand its relationship to, you know, what you're doing right now. So, you know, it's timely. It didn't seem timely. It was a very sad place. The book took 7 years to write. And during that time, many, 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 many contemporary issues came up.
Thank you.
And it was very tempting to say, I can't write about this happening in 1889. It's going on in 2011, 11, 10, 9, no. 12, 13, 14, 15. It's happening right now. I think though that in writing about the past, I am writing about the present at the same time. It's really, you know, these folks, when I look at the levels of kind of psychological warfare that they had to contend with in the Mitchell Show, and the decisions that they had, very difficult, personal, ethical decisions that they had to make under very strenuous circumstances. I think that those questions, those dilemmas are timeless. So they're still relevant for today, and they will, chances are, be relevant in the future. Long rambling answer.
Thank you. People keep saying, Tamba Jess, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize.
They say it exactly like that.
No, they do that. Don't you know Tamba Jess? He's the, right? Where does that hit you in your body, and how does that make you feel? Because obviously you've been writing before you were the Pulitzer Prize. So what do you feel? Where does it hit you when they say that?
Well, you know, I was fortunate enough to meet Gwendolyn Brooks. So I lived in Chicago for 18 years. I met Gwendolyn Brooks on several occasions, and I got to see how she wrote. You know, and I think, you know, meeting first black winner of the Pulitzer. It just makes me put myself in context of I'm trying to at least not embarrass that legacy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I feel like I when you're writing a book, in your middle of writing a book, you know, all you're thinking is, really, is this the best I can do at this particular? Is this the best I mean? It's a crazy book. It really is. I didn't intend it to be this long. You know, I didn't intend it to take as long as it took. It's a crazy book. I wasn't even clear how it was going to look until the end. Really, until like 5 years in, what it was going to look like. And you're not thinking about that. All you're really thinking is, how do I tell this story? How do I do justice by the people that are in the book? And how do I keep on doing that? So, you know, receiving the news about the Pulitzer was a real shock, and it kind of raises the stakes a little bit. And all I can really say is I just have to go into the next thing I write with the same kind of sensibilities. You know, just make it the absolute best thing I can at that particular time. That's what it represents. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when you talk about legacy, I think there are many of us who either are just like, I just want to write this book and get it done. And then there are some of us who are like, there's a lot weighing on me for the people who wrote before me. Do you consider OEO an act of resilience or an act of resistance?
Both. Because the folks in it that I'm writing about were resilient. You know, they were able to resist being broken down. You know, they were able to, they were seeking ways to maintain their integrity. And that is a form of resistance. The act of, even the act of maintaining, you know, being able to sing under these very difficult circumstances, even if it's a work song, and it's there and it's helping you endure the very difficult labor of picking cotton, cutting trees, etc., etc. But it becomes an art form unto itself, and you and it's become so beautiful and so living and so vibrant that even the people who enslave you actually become jealous of it. Jealous of your ability.
Let me process that for a second.
Think about it. But I'm jealous of your ability to create this music that moves even them to the point that becomes the national sound. That becomes the sound of America. Right? And I think that's a kind of resistance that allows one to see the kind of beauty one can create out of just oneself. When you don't own anything else, you don't own your skin, you don't own your babies, you don't own your sex, you don't own your life mate, right? The thing you come closest to owning, like you don't own the clothes on your back, nothing. Thing you end up coming close to owning the most is the sound and the songs and the music that you generate. Because nobody else can do that but you, right? And I think that is a kind of resilience and kind of resistance under very difficult circumstances. That, you know, is a life-saving kind of resilience. And then and that's how you get spirituals and blues and jazz and all of that. And is that not a life-giving energy in this very difficult country? I don't know. That's a rambling answer. So, yeah.
I like your rambling
answer. You asked about timing before, and I do want to point out Bettina Jill.
Hey, Dr. Jill.
Right over there, who wrote a fantastic book that is in the same time period, right, that explores the history of gynecology and the way it was developed on the bodies of black women. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, very, very great book. And I talk about it because we're still talking about these issues today. I also want to talk about Gary Lilly. Where you at, Gary? Where's Gary? Gary out there, right? Who wrote a fantastic book about a town in North Carolina, Wilmington, North Carolina. It was the only actual coup staged on a city government in this country's history. When my folks just said, these black folks, they have too much power. You just have to take it to where you're from, no matter what. And I think, you know, I working in history like that, it gets a little lonely and isolated, because you're working back and you're working like 150 years ago, you know, and when you see people working in the same area, you know, it gives you kind of sustenance and heart. And they did such a fantastic job. So thank you. Shout out to them. Thank you.
From the audience is, what was the research process like for for the book, and when did you start?
Okay, it was more or less started around 2008 or so, late eight, early nine, and more or less it was finished somewhere around 15. The last galleys were 15, the end of 15, right? And so it was about 7 years. And essentially, what was the process? The process was read, and then write. And then read, and then write. And read, and write. And read, and write. And read, and write. And read, and write. And read. That's essentially what it was. There's a bibliography in the back of the book that has the books. I think the majority of the books that I was able to access in order to get the information that's in the book. So I built a library around the book and delved in from there. I say that only because I thought it's just important to at least know what the basic facts are about these folks, because our history has been so disrespected, so obfuscated, so trashed and deformed that, you know, I wanted to make my best effort to get the facts as accurate as I could, and then take it from there.
And how many years again?
Seven.
A long time. In a long time.
I get that. Right.
Yeah. Someone wants to know, how do you go about writing your lines such that they can be read in multiple ways? I'm guessing they want to know, like, did you study the format of the craft? Did you start writing it in a way that the lines could respond to each other? Did it happen organically and then you reconstructed them?
You know, it was all experiments. So, I mean, you know, when people talk about experimental poetry, you know, that's essentially what was happening here. You know, there are some contrapuntal poems in my first book, Lead Belly, but they aren't in form. Many of these aren't in form. So, I wanted to take where I came from with Lead Belly and take it a step further. I couldn't just do a contrapuntal poem. I had to bring it up a level. So then it essentially became a motif of the book. Because I said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the contrapuntal idea and just push it as hard as I possibly can. And then little wrinkles started appearing. And I followed some of the wrinkles and they ended up in being in the ability to read it in multiple directions. And so that's essentially what happened. I didn't really intend for that to happen, but it ended up happening, and I followed it as much as I possibly could.
Which work are you most proud of?
Which work meaning?
It could be which work in the book. It could be which of your works between Lead Belly and OAO.
I can't short one. Can't do that. Ain't no Oleo without Lead Belly. Mm. It just doesn't happen. So, Lead Belly was, you know, if you want to look at like in a different language, Lead Belly was like proof of concept. And then Oleo is taking that proof and doing it in a different kind. Lead Belly was one person very, like, really deep. And then Oleo was many people over, like, that are stretched out in different kind of ways. Same principles, but done, but approached differently. Yeah.
Did you feel like Lead Belly's more persona poems?
Well, all of them are persona poems. Lead Belly, you know, Lead Belly was started during a very difficult time during my life, to be completely honest. And Lead Belly had a lot of rage, and he was learning how to funnel his rage into his art. And that's part of what I was doing when I was writing that ballad. And so there's a different kind of connection with that belly that I have. So, but no lead belly, no lead.
Do you feel free on the page?
Yes.
Why?
Well, you know, I guess I feel free, but I also feel fear. it can be very intimidating approaching a blank page and, oh man, no, I've got to make something happen. You know, that's what I do. But I think that, you know, somewhere in the middle of once getting past the fear and everything, I feel opportunity. I feel opportunity to do things or to go in places that haven't necessarily been gone to before. Okay, and I think that is that's a fantastic level of freedom. And I think it would be, since we're talking about history in this context, I also have to think about the fact that not that many generations ago, I would be lynched for trying to write this book. Or just even trying to read. So, you know, I feel a kind of, I feel a freedom and a responsibility. I mean, I know that's not a really popular word when you're talking about, you know, poetry, so to speak, thinking about freedom and stuff. But I do feel, you know, when I'm working within the context of history, I do feel a responsibility. I do try to understand how I'm working in that context today.
How do you think writing the book affected your relationship with spoken word or word performance? You know, it's a dicey issue. Someone could say, if you were just reading the work, people would tune out and say, oh, it's just whatever, you know. But you have visuals, and so people can say, oh, there's a craft to that, so.
Yeah. You know, that's a good question, because actually when I was writing these books, these poems, I was like, okay, Jess, what does that mean? That means you're going to have to basically have a projector every time you read these. Right? And that's a real, you know, tactical and real, you know, that's an obstacle. But at the same time, I thought, well, you know, if I can just get the opportunity to, you know, throw them up on the screen, really, you know, the first time I did the McCoy Twins was in public, I think. Well, the first time I did them in New York in public, I think it was with Youssef Komiak. This thing called Page Meets Stage. I was trembling, man. You know, because it was Youssef Komiak.
I know.
So, but no. Getting back to the idea of slam, though, I come from slam. I was on two slam teams, Green Mill, Chicago, where slam started. Look at Patricia Smith, who was one, you know, still one of my mentors. You know, Patricia Smith. Yeah. If you haven't read Patricia Smith, nah, you really need to get her in your life. But, you know, fantastic poet, came directly out of slam. I knew back in the day, I don't care what anybody says, she's one of the best poets in the country. And it turns out that, you know, years later, you know, everybody is seeing that for what it is. And she's just, you know, she's able to prove, you know, that the harder you work on the page, in certain ways, the less you have to work on the stage. You know, you can see the craft and the work that she puts in those books. And when you read those poems, you hear her. And I took that as a great lesson. Now, you know, I think, talking about slam just for a hot second, really, Mark Smith, who started slam, deserves a special kind of recognition for doing that. Because really, frankly, slam has really revolutionized our approach to poetry. Poetry had been so locked up in the academy in so many ways that, you know, what slam provided was just a chance for ordinary Joe to go to a bar and hear some poems that he might, or he or she would ordinarily never hear. And it gave agency to a huge, like, generations of poets, you know, that were able to access that opportunity and sharpen their craft.
Yeah. So one can be a slam poet and an academic poet and a writer too. I think that's important. I think sometimes we get categorized. You just have to be one of those things. You're not allowed to be more than one.
You can do it all, you know? You can do it all.
You touched on it a little bit, but I want to know what are more of the qualities from Lead Belly and Olio? I feel like Lead Belly ghosts, there's a ghost of Lead Belly in Olio. Just for people who haven't read Lead Belly.
Okay, well, Lead Belly is about Hoodie Ledbetter. It's called Lead Belly. Lead Belly was out of Louisiana, born in the mid-1880s, died in 1949 in New York. He knew about 500 songs off the top of his head, was a master of the 12-string guitar, and had a violent past. He killed a man over a woman in his youth, and then he served time for that, and he stabbed the guy very much over a song. So he had a temper. But he is at the cornerstone of American folk music. You can't talk about American folk music without talking about Lead Belly. And I was starting to say this. There was a phenomenon in England called skiffle music. Okay? Some of you may be familiar. But all of those people, all of the British invasion people, I'm talking about the Rolling Stones, I'm talking about Led Zeppelin, I'm talking about the Beatles, they all were playing skiffle. In the mid-1950s, and skiffle was based off of Lead Belly, period. Okay? So, getting back to you know, his relationship, you know, and Olio, this is a little story. Okay, it took 5 years to write Lead Belly. Okay? So it's like 5 years living with the same dude all the time in your head. Constantly, like, trying to generate poem. And yeah, there's a certain quality to his voice in that work, in Lead Belly. And so for about 3 years after writing it, every time I sat down to write, it was Lead Belly coming up again. And one of the reasons I went into form for Olio was to get his voice out of my head. Because I did sonnets, and he's not really a sonnety.
I mean, it could be.
Yeah, it could be. And there are some sonnets in the book, but at the very end, because there's a crown of sonnets for the king of the 12-string guitar. Right? But it took me into a different kind of voice that I really needed to access in order to get away from the kind of energy in his voice. And then the sonnets led to this and that and the other. And it helped me move on. But you know, he did, you know, he is there. He is there. I won't say which one he inhabits the most, but he is there.
Well, I won't either, but someone from the audience wants you to read Miss Fire, or at least give it some context.
Which one?
Miss Fire.
Miss Fire, I think, is that the one where Lead Belly is in the river? Yeah, I'm sorry. It was a lot of poems. Remember them all by name.
Tell this person you have to buy the book.
Yeah, you gotta buy the book, man.
You stand in line. Point to it.
So I don't know. I think Miss Fire. I think Miss Fire is the one where. Actually, you know what? That's a good question, because that was the very, very first poem written for that book, if I remember correctly. And what it's basically taking from a time when Lead Belly escaped from prison at one point. He was running from the dogs. Dogs chased him in the middle of Red River, down in
Texas. And he was getting across the river, but the dogs was catching up to him. So he drowned one of them dogs. And the prison warden was real close to putting a bullet in Leadbelly, because of course he killed one of his dogs. But it was the first one written for that book. And for me, it represented a real breakthrough. And I guess really it was written because I was feeling pursued at that point. And, I was feeling that kind of hellhound on my trail. Take that to Robert Johnson. So, there you go.
You know, I'm really sad because I have to just ask you one more question.
Okay.
And then you have to go be whisked away and sign books. Tons of folks.
Glad to do that.
Who is this book for?
Me. Should be for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess what I mean is like this, is something I think Toni Morrison said, is that you need to write the book that you believe needs to be in the world that hasn't been written yet. And so it was written, you know, there are no promises, there are no guarantees. This whole poetry thing, or literature, particularly poetry, you don't know what's going to happen. So if you're gonna spend your energy doing this, you know, you need to write something that's gonna make you happy in the end.
Mm-hmm.
You can't plan on what's gonna make everybody else happy. You need to make you happy. So it's written for me, number one. And number two, it was written in communication with the people that are in the book. Because I felt like you deserve to be remembered. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I just wanna try to capture a little bit of your story as truthfully and as elegantly as I know how to do. And I take it from there. There you go.
I told her I'm still waiting for her to come to the studio.
Marlowe.